Theme of leadership of self. What does it mean to really lead yourself? Because the women and the men that have made the greatest difference in the world so often have been those that in different measure have been able to conquer and lead themselves. Now, it would be not true to say that they were perfect people. Because actually, when you look at the people that have achieved the great things in life, if we were to ask a list of names of who they were, you know, names like Martin Luther King or Gandhi or whatever, people like that would come out, these were not perfect human beings. Nelson Mandela, definitely not a perfect human being. But to an extent, they managed to master who they were and have mastery over who they were. And we looked last night at that amazing story of the two sons and the glorious, gracious father we've been celebrating this morning, and asked the question, well, who do you think you are? And actually, a more important question is not so much about who you think you are, but who you're going to become. What next is always the most important question. What next? So we're going to explore that a little bit this morning. And I wonder if you'd allow me to and tolerate me just to share a couple of ideas. And I want us to show you a video clip first. How many of you here have children under the age of 10? How many of you? Yeah, a few of you. Great. So you may well have seen this next clip, but I just thought it's a really helpful clip to introduce this morning's session. So please look to the screens right and left if you would. Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. So it is a really amazing movie. It's a really amazing movie in terms of helping us to understand how the human mind works. And the challenge and the role of self-mastery often begins in here. In here. And there are lots of the parents here recognize that particular moment. How many of you here have ever been to DEFCON 3? DEFCON 4? Yeah, you wouldn't have survived. You wouldn't be here. No, you wouldn't be here. So, and I just wondered if you'd tolerate me just to talk a little bit about the human mind. So I mentioned yesterday, part of my role, I'm a business psychologist by profession, by training. And so I spend quite a lot of time thinking. Could I have my image on the screen, please? About the human brain. Let me just explain to you this model. This is a model by a man called Alexander Lowen, who's a psychologist, spent a great deal of time thinking about the human brain and how it works and how we engage with the world. And I'm not going to go on about this, but I think it's really quite interesting. So he says the human condition really is fourfold. So at the outside circle, you have the ego. You have the kind of what's presented to the world. We present our ego to the world. It's the kind of thing that people bumped into when they meet us. You know, and that's the thing from which we create all our perceptions about other human beings. This kind of ego thing that turns up, and that's what turns up in the room. And I was talking to once a whole group about 50 or 60 doctors about this. And so I said, so you've just met me for about 20 minutes now. So I said, give me a list of words that describe who I am. And so people started to throw out words, you know, loud, vivacious, suave, sophisticated. You know, all these different words started to come out. And then this lady stuck her hand up, and she said, you're like Shrek. And she kind of paused after she was sentenced. She said, you're a little bit like an onion. You peel away different layers, find different things. But she just got like, you're like Shrek. And they all laughed, which I thought was really hurtful. Anyway, so the ego, that's what turns up. That's what turns up. That's made up of three things, Alexander Lowen says. Firstly, the next layer is our muscle, our body language. 60% of everything we communicate, and if you've got teenage daughters, you know this really well, yeah, is physical, it's nonverbal. Most of what we communicate is nonverbal. As a police officer, we were trained to actually pick up those signals, you know, because human beings are complex individuals and they communicate complex messages through their body language, Chelsea fans aside, but the rest of them are pretty complex human beings and they communicate things about themselves through physicality. The second thing then is our emotions. Our emotions are our filters. They filter everything on the way in and they filter everything on the way out, which then turns into behavior within the ego. And then right at the center, you've got the core. And I like to describe the core in this way. The core is the place we tell ourselves stories about ourselves that we believe to be true. The core is the place we tell ourselves stories about ourselves that we believe to be true. And they're a little bit like this. When I was a young kid, we didn't have much money. And so I come from a kind of quite a poor background. So we're going to my grandmother's in the East End of London. And the big treat was she'd buy this big tin of candies called Quality Street. Do they have those here in the colonies? They have those, Quality Street? Yeah, great, okay. So got away with that. And big tin of Quality Street. And what we would do, we would sit and we'd eat Quality Street. And then we'd sit and watch her black and white television, but through the wrappers of the Quality Street. And pretend we had a color TV like the middle class kids. And that was our Christmas treat. So my favorite is caramel and hazelnut. So the color is purple. Yeah. So I watched The Wizard of Oz in purple every Christmas. I mean, it was amazing. And these stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, we be true, they are all defining. They color every single thing. They color everything. And our stories are all defining. They're the narrative that we work out. They're the play, that the act that we kind of perform every single day. We're doing it here now. We're living out our stories. And as we talked about last night, what we want to do is to make sure our story is anchored in the story of a loving God who said, come home, to which we said, thank you, I will. That's where we want our story anchored. And so those stories are all defined. They shape who we are. And sometimes there are multiple stories. I shared yesterday, I'm quite an insecure guy. And, I grew up with this narrative that I wasn't good enough and I assumed people would reject me. And I've been on lots of counseling courses and stuff. And my parents, I had a brother who died after 3 months. And his name was Philip. He died before I was born. So my parents named me after my dead brother. My parents were lovely people. But that wasn't the brightest move. And so I've grown up all of my life not being that guy and not feeling good enough to be good, and assuming that, people will reject me because I'm just not good enough. I'm just not that guy. So my assumption in life is that eventually I'll be rejected. My wife, my kids, my clients, you. Don't give a damn, frankly, but you. That's my assumption. So that's one of my stories. That's part of Phil Wall's story. But there's another story as well that I've got. I'm 52 years of age. I'm fitter and stronger than most of the 35-year-olds that I know. I've been married to my drop-dead gorgeous childhood sweetheart for over 30 years now. I've got 3 fantastic kids that I've got a great relationship with. I started an organization that changes the lives of over 250,000 people every single year. I've done 3 jobs. I've been good at all 3 jobs. The job I do now, I'm very good at and get paid very well for. And you know what? Quite a lot of people like me as well. They're mentally unwell, but they like me. And I'm that guy as well. I'm this complex mix. These stories exist inside of me. And the thing is, it's not like the weather. People think that those emotions, those thoughts, are a little bit like the weather. It just comes along, there's nothing you can do about it. That's just not true. And if I have more time, maybe we'll do some of this tomorrow, I'll explain what we understand about science and neuroscience these days, about how much more control we've got over how we feel about ourselves. We're not victims to the weather. We can take control and mastery over our emotions. We're nobody's victim. We really aren't. And so who are we? And it's a really, really important question for the people of God. Because understanding who we are and what we are and what we're about is a really important part of our identity. I'd like to share a little bit of my identity with you this morning, if I may. This actually is an illustration. Yes, it's a fire sale. Yeah, these are going really cheap in my country at the moment. Yeah, you get a job lot. Anyway. Yeah, no, they didn't. No, not for long. Anyway, we visited. Anyway, we're just there to make up the numbers. But there actually is a point of me wearing this. Not so I don't have to change my shirt in time for the match later, but there actually is a point which will become clear shortly. So I want us to look at the story this morning of 4 men who had a sense of who they were and what they were about. Yeah? Who sought to master themselves in a really, really challenging and abusive and aggressive and domineering environment. We're going to learn from them, see if there are lessons that we can learn from them in their context. So if you have your Bibles, what I'd love you to do is turn to the book of Daniel. Okay, Daniel was an Old Testament book, and it tells about events that took place quite a long time before Jesus was actually born. So we're going to look at 3 parts of the story, and I'm going to ask John to come, and he's going to read for us the first few verses of Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through to 5.
In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put it in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, king of the courts of the officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for everything, every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service.
Right, okay. So this is what they did. The Babylonians, they were amongst the nations that created the kind of methodology of what it means to build an empire. And they did exactly that. What they would do is they would take some of the most talented people from the race that they'd kind of conquered, and they would take them into their own country. So they would take them into their country, and they would change their names. Now, in that culture in those days, as still in many cultures today, the name you're given is really important. It's defining for who you are. Far less these days in our society, Western society. But in those days, very, very important. Okay, so they would change their name. They would change their religion. They would change their language. They would change their food. They would often even change their location. And by doing so, they would get rid of their old identity of who they were, and they would be drawn into this new identity, this new reality of the conquering nation. And the Babylonians were amongst those who actually kind of perfected that particular art. And one of the groups that actually took it on some years later were called the British. That's what we did. That's why I'm wearing the shirt. That's what we did, to our shame. We did that to the Aboriginal peoples of this land, where we changed their language, and we changed their location, and we changed their food, and we changed their religion, and we changed who they were allowed to be and said, come and be like us. We did that to the Aboriginal peoples of India and of Pakistan and of Bangladesh and of places like Indonesia. We did that in places like Africa, all over the subcontinent of Africa. And the British became the best in all of human history at doing just that. And the Americans, and they're trying it in the current day. And actually, the difference these days is in those days, we imposed it by force. These days, the Americans sell it, and everybody wants it. The Googleization of the world. And that's the difference. And we need to remember our history well, because every single empire eventually falls. How many of you here are Star Trek fans? Just lay your hands and let's pray for these people, shall we? Now, anyway, but there's a race called the Borg. Okay, the Borg, they tried to bring the whole universe into their collective. And you would have to take on their customs and their traditions and their language and their culture, etc., etc., etc. That's exactly what the Babylonians did to these four young men. And so they were aliens literally in a foreign land. And they sought as people of God, as God's people, to be distinctive in that environment. And I would like to suggest this to you, that their context is our context. Often when Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, when they talk about what it means to be a follower of Jesus today, and they talk about the Bible, they talk about the New Testament, they suggest that, you know, we're in the New Testament era. We're in the apostolic era. We're in the era of the New Testament church, this church that was in huge ascendancy, that was the growing and dominant force. There was a belief system called Zoroastrianism in the Middle East when Christianity first emerged. Within less than 50 years, it was almost unheard of. So dominant Christianity had become. And the way you hear Christians speak sometimes, I think that that's still our context. We're still in this ascendancy place. Well, in parts of the world, that's true. But in the Western world, that's certainly not true. Gentlemen, we live in Babylon. We live in an environment, we live in a culture which wants us to speak their language and their values and hold their culture and embrace their ideals and value what they value and do the things that they wanted. That's the world that we live in. We live in Babylon. So the challenge that we have is the same as the ones that they have, which is then how do we live authentically and effectively as followers of the living God in our Babylon? How do we do that? How do we confront the challenges that that presents us with? So we're going to look at the two challenges that is presented for these four individuals, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel. Second part of the story, please, if you would, John. Thank you.
Among those chosen were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name of Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion on Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord, the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you look worse than the other men your age? The king would have my head because of you. Then Daniel said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food.
Thank you. Two questions. In Babylon, what battles do you fight? What I'm going to say now isn't easy to hear, but it's true. We sometimes forget our history. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego eventually became very senior civil servants in the civil service of the king of Babylon. And the king of Babylon spent a great deal of his life dominating and committing genocide of other nations. And Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they did his paperwork for him. They helped him be very, very good at genocide, these people of God. When you looked at the Mosaic belief system that they were raised down in Jews and how they actually lived most of their lives, they violated the vast majority of it. They lived in a very, very, very gray and murky world. They disobeyed the Mosaic law of God the vast majority of the time. And they were also involved in genocide and helping Babylon be very, very good at that. That's difficult to hear, but we need to understand that's the historical context. However, what they did do was ask a question: what battles will you fight? And because they were good Jews, they understood that the reason that they were in captivity in the first place was because they had done two things consistently and God had judged them and punished them. Number one, they committed idolatry, they worshipped other gods. Number two, they'd not cared for the widow and the orphan and committed acts of injustice. And for that, they were then sent into captivity. And so they drew the first line. And the first line was a line around food. You see, the food at the king's table, before it hit the king's table, it was offered to false idols. It was offered to foreign gods as a sacrifice. And then it was taken from that, the most succulent food, and put on the king's table, which they were invited to eat. And so they said, we're going to draw this line here around the food, because to eat that food would itself be an act of idolatry, the worship of gods other than the living God. So they chose their battles. To live well in their Babylon, they had to choose which battles they were going to fight. And they drew the line around food. Just pause here for a second. I think it's extraordinary, this particular little narrative that John just read to us. It's extraordinary. So they weren't going to go near any defiled, idolatrous food, as we're going to see in a minute. And they were so not going to do the idolatry thing that they're willing to lay down their lives for it. And yet here we have Daniel saying, hey, listen, guys, tell you what. Why don't you just test it? Let us eat just water and vegetables. And if we look worse at the end than the people eating the king's food, then we will eat that idolatrous food. Now, is that deceit? Was he trying to deceive him? Was he trying to trick him? Or is that a man who was confident in God? And I believe it's that. Too often we as Christians, we're so insecure in our Babylon, the world in which we live. We can't touch that. We can't be with them. We can't be involved in that. We can't partner with them. We can't be engaged with that. Why? Because they're not like us, because they do things that are different to us. They do bad things. So we can't be involved. So we'll withdraw from that and just let them get on with it and run the world as they see fit. That's not the way these guys did in their Babylon. They had confidence in their God that when they made a statement, God would deliver. How confident are you? Because too often we are deeply, deeply insecure. And we make these statements about what we believe and what we do and what we shouldn't do. And we wrap it up in this kind of theological gobbledygook. But basically, we're just frightened. We're just insecure. We've got to have more confidence in God. He's the God that spoke the world into being and raised his son Jesus from the dead, who is the Lord of heaven and earth. And he that is in us is greater than he that is in the world. So we've got to be confident. We've got to man up a bit when it comes to being confident in God. So they drew their line. God honored the line they'd drawn. And the king's official allowed them just to not defile themselves and eat the vegetable and water. But of course, the second question they had to ask then, well, how expensive will this be? So we jump forward a few years to chapter 3. And what God's done, John's going to come up and read this, but what's happened is this, that Nebuchadnezzar has built this huge idol. And we understand that everyone would have known what this place was. It's a bit like being in Sydney and saying, oh, I was walking past the Sydney Opera House the other day. He built this enormous thing. Everybody knew what it was. And we think it was actually an idol of himself. And he said, he was sent an edict throughout the land and said, when the trumpets sound, etc., etc., if you do not bow down and worship the idol of me, actually, you will be killed. And people were very jealous of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel because they had so much favor and they were just loved and had so much authority. So people, out of jealousy, went to the king and said, oh, great, O king, these four people, these Jews, they do not do as you say. So Sunshine, you need to do something about it because they are disobeying you. Why? Because to bow down and worship anything other than the living God was once again idolatry. And they'd already drawn their lines. John, read to us if you would.
Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now, when you hear the horn and the flute, lither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to bow down and worship the image that I have made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then where will your God be to rescue you from my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into a blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of your gold that you have set up.
So, and then the story goes on. So the king, enraged, then throws them into the furnace and looks inside to see them being fried like a big kind of Jewish barbecue and realizes that wasn't happening. The bonds, the ropes that were tied them had been burnt away and they're standing in them, and alongside of them is an angel. And so God rescues them. But what I love about that particular part of the story is this. They say to him, again, confidence again, hey, Nebuchadnezzar, I God, he can rescue us. Furnace thing, no problem for the God that created heaven and earth. He can rescue us. But, Nebuchadnezzar, understand this, sunshine, rough translation, obviously. Understand this, Sonny Jim. Even if we fry, we will not bow down and worship your false idols. To be a follower of the living God is a costly thing. That's why it deserves everything of you. That's why it demands everything of you. And I'm 52, we must apologize to those of you that are younger than us. We have sanitized the Christian faith. We have sanitized this radical, revolutionary, dramatic, powerful, inspiring faith journey called Christianity. And we've made it this safe, saccharine kind of cuddly cotton wool thing, which is not worth giving much to in too many ways. And we apologize. We really apologize. Because often what we've portrayed to you is not the Jesus story. And often what we've shown you certainly is not worth dying for. But what these guys believed, what deep down we know to be true, that's worth dying for, men and women. That's really, really worth dying for. And so here were the two questions they had to ask. What battles do you fight? Where do you draw your lines? And how much are you willing to pay? So let's just pause for a second. And again, we said yesterday, we want this to be a conversation, not a conference. So what's your Babylon like? What are the challenges that you often face in your Babylon? What are things that come in your direction? And what are things that you find particularly difficult? Well, how are you nudged? How are you buffeted? How are you pushed around? How are you challenged in your life? I'd love you to have a conversation with some people about that. So Nathan's going to help us and some of his buddies at the back. We've got here a bunch of cards. They've got road signs on them. Okay, I think they're Australian road signs. I hope they're Australian road signs. You should have the same ones as us, but you don't, which is not good. But anyway, you don't. And I just love you to just look at some of these road signs. For example, you might say, hey, there's a roundabout here. My life's a bit like a roundabout. I go round and round and round and round. And I just never seem to get off it. And that's my challenge. I just keep going round and round in circles. I can't make a decision about what it is I'm going to do next. Or there's a road narrowing sign. You say, things just seem to be narrowing. I don't seem to have any options. Things are struggling. I'm finding that really, really difficult. Or there's a sign of a car going up a really steep hill. You know, things are really tough for me. I'm trying to get up this hill. I'm finding it really difficult. Or there's a picture that they have outside schools of someone holding a child's hand. You know, you say, hey, my children, they're real challenging me, whatever. So what are the challenges for you at the moment living in your Babylon? What do they look like? And just use some of the images on here to express that in some way. Hey, my life, my Babylon, this is what it's like for me, okay? And these things, like with the wire, they're just catalysts for conversation. Okay, nothing special about them. They're just catalysts for conversation. So for the next 6-7 minutes, I'd love you to stand up, go find some people you don't really know, and have a conversation using the symbol. Say, hey, this is what it's like for me in my Babylon. This is what it's like for me in my life at the moment. These are challenges that I'm facing. And have that conversation together. Can you do that? So let's be upstanding. Let's go find some people we don't know. And let's have that conversation. Away we go. We're good now. Okay. Let me just offer three things if I could. Three things. Lessons from Babylon. How do we master self? How do we live well in Babylon? How do we do that? What do we learn from these guys? Well, lesson number one, state the obvious, is we persevere through the hard days. We persevere through the hard times. When it gets tough, we keep going. When it gets tougher, we still keep going. When it gets even tougher and tougher, we just keep going. Persevere through the hard times. One of us will share a little story about an experience I had where I learned that lesson again afresh and anew. In 2003, I was sitting with a friend of mine at Twickenham. That's where they play rugby in my country. And we were playing the French. And we were actually beating the French for once. And I was sitting next to my friend who's an explorer. We came up with this idea of organizing a trip to take 15 business people to a place called the North Pole. This is the North Pole. It's a geographic North Pole. There are actually three North Poles, and there's true North, there's the geographic North Pole, and there's magnetic North Pole. So we started to set about plans to take 15 business people and three guides to the geographic North Pole, and over a kind of 12 to 15 day period over the Easter of 2004. And you can only go there over about a 6 to 7 week period because it's either too cold and too dark, or it's too warm and the ice has all melted and it's just open water. And so, just to be clear, the North Pole, there's no land at all. It's just a big floating ice cube. It's just a big floating ice cube. You can imagine, you're just on a big, big ice cube. That ice cube is sometimes a mile thick, but it's just an ice cube. That's all the North Pole is. Frozen polar pack ice. And so what you do is you... have I got a little thingy on here? No, I don't. I thought I did have a little light thingy on there. I don't. Anyway, thought I did. And you, above Greenland, you see a place called Svalbard, S-V-A-L-B-A-R-D, just over on the left there, about 11 o'clock. That's the archipelago of Greenland. And so we flew into there. And then after some training there on the ice caps, we then flew and landed on the North Pole. Landed on the ice. Now, the Russians build a camp there every year. And the only point I was actually scared was landing in a Russian jet that works worse than your billy carts. And no seat belts. Yeah, no seat belts, just nutty. And we landed there. And so there's this camp that's run by the Russians. And the bizarre thing is, I wasn't scared about this, but I was mildly anxious, was everybody was drunk. The helicopter pilot was drunk. The guards with the machine guns were drunk. The doctors that would help you if the guards with the machine guns shot you, they were also drunk. Everybody was drunk. It's the Wild West. So we spent a couple of days there getting ready. Then when the weather improved, we then began what was a nine-day journey to walk 100 miles across the polar ice cap to the North Pole. And so this is me. And you'll see on a video I'm going to show you in a second, what happens just after that? Because someone says, Phil, and they took a photograph, and then I fell right on my face. I went absolutely flying. So anyway, I just want to show a brief video we made of it. This video will give you more sense, and then let me tell you about the lessons that we learned in that environment. So if you could look at the screens to my right and left, and this is a video that we made of the trip when we got back. So there were all sorts of challenges on that. Could I have my pictures back, please? All sorts of challenges on that trip. And one was, up until the trip, I'd never had a ski on my foot. My friend said to me, it's no problem, you'll pick it up quickly. I didn't pick it up that quickly. I'm a bit of an uncoordinated numpty, really, and I just kept falling over. So eventually, I just walked a lot of the way. Problem is, every time you step down, your foot dropped down about 8 to 10 inches. And that, for 100 miles, is quite challenging on the quads. And so over these last 25 years or so, I've just had this nutty dedication to putting myself and my body in a place that it probably shouldn't be. So there were just a few challenges we had on here, apart from the fact I couldn't ski. The first is obvious, is it was so flipping cold. So it kind of normed out about 28, minus 28, minus 29. And then when the wind got up, the wind chill factor was sometimes another 7 or 8 below that, so like mid to late minus 30s. And that's pretty cold. That really is quite nippy. Particularly when you're sitting down trying to have a dump. It's really, really nippy. Because it freezes your nadges off in a really, really bad way. You've got to be really, really careful. And you know what? It gets even smaller. But I probably shouldn't have said that anyway. But so it was cold. And you know what? Walking was okay because you were warm. But when you stopped, you just started to shake. And so there was 5 hours between when we'd stopped and when we'd set camp and when we put the tents out and when we'd melt the ice to make the food and cook the food. And you're trying to light a gas cooker and you're going like this and you're absolutely freezing your nadgers off and it's really, really challenging. That was challenging. It was really, really cold. Second challenge were these little puppies. And these are some of the biggest killers on the planet, actually, when they come in contact with humans. Not as much as the sharks you have out there, but that's another whole issue which we're going to leave alone. Why you as a nation can't get that, that's where they play. We play here, they play there. They've got lots of teeth that says so. And anyway, so we saw some tracks. We didn't actually see any polar bears. The third challenge was this. When the ice comes together, the ice breaks up and forces together, because the PSI is extraordinary, as the ice comes up and they create these ice walls. It took us 4 hours to travel 800 meters. And then the biggest challenge, though, was this. We kept coming across these. And that's what they call an open lee, where the ice has opened up. And it's just open water, or actually just a thin layer of ice across the top. And, you know, around about here where we were on the map, you know, that's like 2 miles straight down. So we weren't going swimming. So what happens is the ice floes are moving all the time. And for most of the trip, the ice flow moved against us. So we walk 8 miles in a day on average, burning over 6,500 calories during that day because your body works overtime to keep yourself warm, and then the physical exertion was very significant. And then we'd pitch camp, we'd go to sleep, and then the negative drift would take us back 5 miles. So it would take us half of the next day to get to where we finished the night before. That's a little bit soul-destroying, particularly when you're so cold. So that drift was against us all the time. And we had about a day and a half to travel 18 miles. And that wasn't good, because to get to the end, and the Russians said they were going to pick us up. They said they'd pick us up in 45 minutes from when we phoned them, when we radioed on the sat phone. It actually took them 9 hours to come and pick us up. And then one of the women on the team, her kidneys packed up in that time. Wasn't good. Anyway, so we just kept coming across these things. So anyway, so the guide said to us, look, you guys, it's one of the guides in the red jacket, said, you guys pitch tent, you pitch camp, and we'll go try and find a bridge, you know, see if it's come together. So they went off, and they went to try and find a bridge, and they came back about 3 hours later. They said, well, there's bad news and there's good news. And I said, okay. No, we said, okay. So what's the bad news? So the bad news is there is no bridge. So the good news is, it appears that the opposite bank is starting to move towards us. And over the next 4 or 5 hours, we went to sleep, and then the next 4 or 5 hours later, all of that had moved towards us. And the next day, we walked straight across it, walked hard all day, and then later that night, the next day, we walked for nearly 26 hours, and we reached the North Pole and reached our destination. What did we learn? We learned this really simple lesson. Sometimes you just got to hang in there. Because that thing which had been our greatest enemy all that time, that negative drift, pulling the ice against us, right at the end when it mattered the most, it became our greatest friend. And I've been a leader for quite a few years now, and I've seen that principle work time and time again. Sometimes you haven't got a clue what to do when you're trying to live well in Babylon. Sometimes it's just not clear what you should do to make the biggest difference. But what you got to do is just persevere and just keep on going and hang in there. Lesson number one. Very quickly before we go for coffee. Lesson number two. If you don't master yourself will master you. We read a story like that. We think, oh, that's good. You know, Daniel ate water and vegetables for a few weeks. Proved his point. Wrong. Because of the dating of the different kings, we know when the different kings rules. He ruled till the end of King Cyrus, as it says later on in the chapter. Daniel ate vegetables and water for 40 years. 40 years. No doubt during that, even decaf instant coffee would have seemed appealing. If you've just eaten vegetables, James, please sort that out. If you've just eaten vegetables all that time. 40 years. Daniel mastered himself. He mastered his appetites. He mastered his emotions. He mastered his desires. He mastered those things, those emotions and those drivers within him, which sometimes lead us to destructive and damaging places. Every single one of us knows exactly what that's like. And if you do not master yourself will master you. A good friend of mine, who's a Salvation Army officer, good man, talented, gifted man, good friend of mine. He didn't master himself. And after a good few years of really effective ministry, opening new churches, doing all sorts of amazing stuff, he was eventually arrested for sexual assault on 2 young girls. And he went to prison. And I went as a character witness to court for him. And that was the first time I sat and heard what he'd done. And when I understood it, I said to him afterwards in the prison, I said, I've got to be honest, mate. If I'd have been the judge, I'd have put you away for a lot, lot longer than he has. He's a good friend of mine. Didn't master himself. His temptations, his emotions, his fear, his anxiety, his needs drove him. If you want to live well in Babylon, you've got to master yourself or yourself will master you. And after coffee, we're going to look at some ideas as to how we might do that more effectively. Thirdly, and finally, find a Babylon story and tell it. Find a Babylon story and tell it. There's been a really interesting phenomenon in the church over the last 120, 130 years. You see, the church used to be the place where the best ideas came from. We dominated the arts, people like Johann Sebastian Bach, a deeply committed follower of Jesus, wrote some of the most beautiful music in praise and honor of God. We used to dominate things like the arts. We used to dominate things like education. We used to dominate things like politics. We used to dominate things like media. We used to dominate these things because the church was where the best ideas came from. The church was the place where just the most creative things took place. And then something bizarre happened. Through a movement called Puritanism, all the stuff came up, we began to draw from the world. We said, oh, don't be involved in those dirty things. You'll get your hands messed up. Just be involved in pure things. And then we came up with this kind of perverse view of priesthood and said, well, this is the ultimate highest calling, to be one of these. Not to do that kind of mucky stuff where you get your hands dirty. Be one of these people. And so we withdrew from the world. We withdrew from Babylon and hid behind our church doors and allowed Babylon to be run by every other person, none of whom, or next to none of whom, loved Jesus. And the reason why 12 and 13-year-olds now get most of their education from pornography about human relationships is because of that decision. And if you don't believe that, that's because you don't understand the evolution of culture and history in the Western world. That's all. Got to go back to Babylon then. We've got to get back into Babylon really, really quickly. Because that's where we belong. Psalm 137. There was a rock band in the 80s called Boney M. They wrote a song on Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon. Keep going. Where we sat down. Keep going. Where we were. Keep going, last rhyme. And we remember Zion. Okay, that's it. Some of the younger people are going, what on earth is that, for goodness sake? You sad, sad, middle-aged old boys, you know. Yeah. And some of the older people are going, rock music? Anyway, but anyway, that's like, I love that notion. You know, saying, that hand's been up for a long time. I'm sitting there thinking, it took him that long to get the hand up. Don't ask him to put it down, for goodness sake, you know. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down where we wait, and we remembered Zion. You see, the Jews got it wrong. Because the one place, the songs of Zion, the songs about God, the one place those songs should be sung is in Babylon. Not in Jerusalem, where they already know all the songs. And the church has got to get this. Savage stuff, for goodness sake, we have to get this. It doesn't matter to what happens on a Sunday morning where everyone already knows the songs and agrees with us. It's what's happened on Monday morning that makes the difference to the world. That's where the difference is made. So we've got to get back to Babylon. We've got to get into Babylon because that's where they don't know Jesus and they desperately need him. Because without him, they make dumb and stupid decisions. So for those of you at the farther end of your life's career of work, encourage those around you in their emerging careers and their emerging lives to spend their lives loving Jesus in Babylon. To those of you who are young and have yet to set out on a career path or young enough to change your life, think very seriously about that. We need you in Babylon. We need you in Babylon because that's where the songs of Zion should be sung. Not in Zion where everyone already knows the songs. That's not the point. In the Salvation Army, which is the church I've been part of and so thankful for all of my life, we do this thing. We wear uniforms. And we just got it all mixed up. We wear uniforms on the day when we shouldn't need to, and we don't wear it on the days when we should need to. We wear it on the day when we're with the people, all of whom all know what we believe and what we think and what we do. We all know that already. But when we go and be with people who don't know what we believe and don't know who Jesus is on the Monday, we don't wear it. Someone help me with that. If it's called a witness, which is what I believe it's called. So we've got to get back in Babylon. Think, what does it mean to live in Babylon? So I want to encourage you. And my rant will end here. And we're going to show you a video which is going to send you out the coffee. As we master ourselves, we must learn to persevere. As we master ourselves, we must master ourselves, otherwise our self will master us. And the temptations that are thrust at us every single day in our society from Babylon will destroy us if we do not master ourselves and surrender ourselves to the mastery of Jesus. But at the same time, we must resist the temptation to spend our time in Zion amongst the people who believe that all the things that we believe already and go, because Jesus sent us into Babylon to be salt and light in that environment, because that's where they need to hear the songs of Zion's song. And the only way we can do that is if we come as men to the foot and the feet of Jesus and lay it all at his feet.